The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events. We've had the good fortune to host our guest a number of times since the millennium struck. In 2002 for his novel July, July. In 2005 for The Things They Carried as part of One Book, One Philadelphia. And for the 20th anniversary edition of #3TC in 2010. And now tonight, Dad's Maybe Book. One thing is for sure, because of his fine writing and storytelling, hearts were moved. I expect no less this evening, because Tim's themes are the verities: love, death, courage, right, wrong, truth, time, memory, family, and how we make meaning through the stories that we choose to tell. It's the stuff that gives our lives value. His writing and talent have been compared to and keep company with some of the greats, names like Crane, Tolstoy, Orwell, and Melville, the Hebrew scriptures. And yet, he couldn't be more approachable. It's an honor to have him back. Please welcome Tim O'Brien. Tim, it's great to have you here again. It's only been 10 years, nine, if my math is correct. So I think you've written a wonderful memoir, and it addresses so many different subjects: a love letter to the boys, an instruction manual for life, a guide to writing and literary analysis, a consideration of the culture, other things as well. But before we talk about any of that, how did you get to be 73?
I should have been dead years ago. I was in Vietnam, I'm a smoker. Got two boys that almost killed me, you know, numerous times. Good luck. That's how I did it.
We're glad you made it this far. So what is a maybe book?
Well, there are numerous answers. One is anecdotal, that I became a father at age 58 for the first time. And decided that I had to quit writing to be a good dad. I'm a slow writer. I was spending 12, 15 hours a day at it. And a father's chief duty is to be there, to be present, beyond anything else. You can't instruct and you can't discipline and be nice to your children and teach them values if you aren't there. And I wasn't. I was at the computer all the time, and if I wasn't at the computer, I was worried about a sentence or about a scene or a scrap of dialogue. So I had to quit. And I did for about 10 years or so. Occasionally I would write a little message to the boys. As I got older, I started worrying that I'd be dead and they'd never know me. So I tried to give them little messages in a bottle and tucked in a desk drawer. Stories about my youth and about Vietnam and about their youths. Some of them funny anecdotes, some of them really sad. And so they'd hear my voice coming through the vowels and the consonants of what I'd writing. These pages added up to maybe 40 of them or so. And at one point, when my youngest boy was seven or so, he saw the pages stacked up on my desk, and he said, "What's that?" And I said, "They're letters to you." And he said, "Is that going to be a book?" And I said, "Maybe." And I said, "Sometimes books end up in the trash can. They're not good enough. You hit a block in the road, and there's no way through the block, and you just can't think of what next." And he said, "Well, what if it does become one? I think you have to call it your maybe book. That is, call it what it is. And I kind of chuckled, and I didn't take it all that seriously. But after a day or two, I thought, well, in my life, just the idea of maybe-ness is maybe the dominant theme that runs throughout it. In Vietnam, every step was maybe I'll be alive and for the next step, or maybe I won't. My area of operations in Vietnam was heavily mined. In 85, 90% of our casualties came from landmines. So every step was maybe. Maybe I'll have another step, maybe not. And then you come into the age of 73, which I am now, and every tick of the clock is a maybe tick. Maybe there'll be another, tomorrow. And then I thought, after another day or so, that there was something wise in what Tad had suggested, in that all of us, in some way or another, are writing our own maybe books. Maybe our dreams will come true. Maybe they won't. Maybe we'll change our dreams, have new ones, modify the old ones. That's certainly how my life has been. Dreams change. I did not want to be a father. And now I walked into this blessed, beautiful, impossible fantasy of a dream that I thought was not in my future. And it's been my life.
Can you give us a brief sketch of each of the boys? I know they're listening tonight, so you'll have to be careful.
Yeah, this is being streamed on YouTube, so they're watching this. This is embarrassing a little bit. Timmy is an earnest, stubborn, kind kid who has a quality of empathy that is way beyond what I have now. I used to have it as a little boy. Now when I see a homeless person, I might give a buck or two out of a kind of embarrassment, and I might not. And to answer the question with Timmy, the best way possible is in a little anecdote, I suppose, that's what I do for a living, is tell stories. And we were in the south of France on vacation when Timmy was, I think, 7 and Tad was 5, at a resort that was way too expensive for us. We didn't know this at the time. It was like a place was populated by George Hamilton kind of people, bronze skin, and everybody looked like Johnny Depp. And they were all rich and bejeweled, and we were so out of place. I was dressed like this, only not this well. And I got a call. We were outside, my wife and I, having a $25,000 glass of Coca-Cola. And the phone rang, and it was my sister calling from San Antonio, and my mom had died. And she told me that. And maybe, I don't know, 5 minutes later, I went over to the boys who were playing ping pong on an outdoor ping pong table. And I told them that my mom had died, and they didn't say much, and I didn't say much. And for the next 2 hours or so, all we did was silently play ping pong, which was much like what was happening in my head, images of my mom at different ages. But we were all silent. And then gradually dusk began to fall, and we went to dinner. And because this resort was so expensive, we would go down to a little village to eat to save, $10,000. On the way down, it's this beautiful purple twilight, and the yachts are bobbing on the blue Mediterranean. And I took Timmy's hand, and I said, "Are you thinking about Grandma?" And he said, "No. I'm thinking about you thinking about Grandma." So that's the kind of boy he is. He cries over people who are standing out on the street as he's driven home from school. He wants mom to stop the car and give them money. I found him one morning at 5 a.m. packing a little grocery bag full of presents for a man he had seen wearing a Vietnam hat who was crying on the street himself. And he put in a granola bar and an apple, some fishing line, strangest stuff, a yo-yo, a copy of one of my books.
Was it one you had assigned to him to read?
Right. Tad is the opposite. Tad is the funniest guy I've ever been around. He should be up here instead of this guy. You would have a ball with this guy talking to you. He takes on personalities. He's got a character called Fish Man. He's got another man called Fat Man Running. Got another, all these characters, and the faces change, and the stories coming out of his mouth change. He will do and say anything. It doesn't have to be appropriate, doesn't have to be germane. It just has to be entertaining. And entertainment is important in life. There's sublime entertainment, and there's, you know, low level. But entertainment is great for the soul when we're engaged and it's good for us. And boy, is he. He, too, has a kind heart. And more than anything, I mean, the two boys, what I value is generosity of spirit and decency and kindness.
So can you talk a bit about how we learn from our children? I think that was sort of something of a surprise for you, or maybe not.
Yes.
And that sort of goes to, in part, the story you were just telling. It's
so important that you start out thinking you're going to instruct your children, and they end up instructing you. The anecdote I just told is one example. I mean, I relearned the lesson of sympathy and empathy and otherness. Another anecdote with Tad is one night we were watching a basketball game on television. It was a playoff game. And in the middle of the game, Tad said, "Hey, Dad, how old was that guy in the Bible, Methuselah?" And I said, "I don't know, 1,000 years old. And then we watched the game for an hour. And then he said, "What exactly did he eat?" And, well, if I, like you guys, I laughed. But after he was dreaming his little boy dreams, 2 hours later, sound asleep, I started thinking, he's looking at, I'm Methuselah. And he wants to give me my broccoli so I'll stay alive longer. And I really think that's what was behind the question.
Yeah.
And that's a kind of learning, the way that the awareness of, I assumed that children of his age back then, 8 or 9, weren't engaged with my oldness. But they were. They realized that the parents of their friends were a full generation and more younger than I am, more than a full generation younger. They noticed I wear hearing aids. They noticed my gray hair. They noticed I'm not so great on the basketball court anymore. That was, I think, Tad's approach to that. Timmy's approach was the opposite. He came out one night just bawling, saying, "You're going to die and I'm not going to have a dad." And I couldn't lie. I just held him and said, "I know. I love you."
Well, maybe we could talk about something a little different at this point. No. Switching from kids, this is an extension of the kids in a way. You've got recurring chapter titles and themes throughout the book, and one of them is The Magic Show. And you're right about the elaborate family productions that you put on and the family puts on for friends. And I wonder if you could talk about what learning magic provided you as a child, and how does it relate to writing?
What a great question. It's been my hobby since I was 7 or 8, very young. I remember going to New York with my dad on a convention. There was a famous magic store called Lou Tannen's And the bravest act of my life up to then was to walk through the streets of New York to find this place at a young age. It began as an escape from some bad stuff in my childhood. It was a way of going into the basement and getting away from what was happening upstairs. My dad was an alcoholic. He was institutionalized twice that I know of. There was tension inside this house. Dinner was tough, just getting through it. Vodka bottles hidden all over the house and in the garage. And I'd empty them and put water in them as a little boy. He was a great human being. It was chemistry. It wasn't that he was evil. It was what happens when alcohol begins to eat up your spirit and your soul and your, and nothing else matters. And a way of escaping that tension was to go in the basement and do magic tricks, where I was living in this illusory world of things are fine. If I can make a penny disappear from my hand and have it change into a white mouse, maybe I'll be able to make my dad stop drinking. Hoping for the impossible. But in magic, the miracles can happen. And so it began that way. And I've continued doing it, except for maybe a few years of not doing it. And I've gotten a lot better at it. I can do slide, I can make card after card after card appear and show my hands empty and grab more out of the air. I've gotten really good at it. The difficulty has been for the kids is that they stand behind me. So to them, it's not magic. They know how it's done. And they say, why do you keep doing this? It's so easy. It's not easy. It's the hardest thing you can do. But we do put on, maybe every 2 or 3 years, we put on a 1.5 hour, 2 hour, full-scale extravaganza with some former students, friends of mine and of my wife. We have costumes and music, and we dance and we sing. There's a plot to the show. 1 year it was set in a desert casino. It had a horny cocktail waitress that everybody's turning down, and all kinds of characters throughout it all, but magic, like 180 tricks in that show, with the hope that it becomes so, there's so many of them, you can't stop to think, to figure them out, because here comes the next one, here's the next one, and to sort of live in this illusory world that this magic all around. Somebody, the waiter brings somebody a drink at a blackjack table, and magic happens. A bottle of wine appears in his hands. Things like that, just one after the other. Some of these, for this show, a roulette table sat in our foyer, the entryway to our house, for 7 months. And so the UPS guy would come. The fact of having a legal gambling thing going on here. I mean, who knows what they thought. It was not a real, but it looked like a real one, and it, magic happened on it. So it went from escape to a different kind of escape. It's much like writing a book, that the people in this book, the new one, they're real people. But words are not people, and you can't put people in a book unless you have a lot of food and water and a really big book. They're words. So there's the illusion that you're reading about my background in Vietnam and my children and the stories that I'm telling in the book, but it is an illusion. You're getting it through the medium of language. And to me, writing a book is very much like doing sleight of hand. It feels the same to me. The miracle of creating a scene. Oh, I mean, it's the hard work that goes into it, and as it does with practicing sleight of hand. But it feels so miraculous when a scene comes alive that it feels like I'm doing miracles.
Well, segueing off that magical writing theme, in the things they carry, you distinguish between happening truth and story truth. And I'm wondering if these ideas in some way can be applied to nonfiction, i.e. this memoir in particular.
Oh, very much. Part of what I just said was kind of a half answer to that question. The sense of it's not real, the things you're reading, because there's these language things. So people are making their own images out of these words. And that's happening with the reader. The reader is building pictures of me and Timmy and my dad and Tad and my wife. It's not the real world exactly. On top of that, memory is faulty, especially mine. I think if I were to ask any of the people in the audience tonight, or you, certainly myself, tell me about yesterday. How much do you really remember? Every word that came out of your mouth, do you remember them all? And the words that came out of your television sets and your radios, and when did the newspaper, what did you read about? That's yesterday. And what about 3 weeks ago? And in my case, 50 years ago, when I think about Vietnam, I do believe that we more or less erase our lives as we live them. Which cabbage do I pick out at the Safeway? And you don't remember so much of what you think is your life. And so when I go to write about the real world, I'm doing it not with an absolute grasp on what occurred. For example, I was wounded in Vietnam. I can't remember much of it. I can remember a hand grenade on the ground fizzling. It was a handmade, we called them Chicom grenades. It looked like a little can of Hunt's tomato paste, about that big, a small can. It's fizzling. And I know my back, I don't remember turning my back to it, but I know I did, because my next memory is maybe 3 seconds, 2 seconds later, and the words, dear Jesus, coming either out of my mouth, which I'm not sure about, or in my head, one of the two. I don't remember the grenade exploding. And the next memory is of a bee sting sensation. And then maybe 5 minutes went by, and I remember looking over my shoulder, surprised, am I in the real world or am I dead? And seeing a kid named Clausen holding his stomach. I was lucky, I was wearing a military radio that took most of the blast, thank God. He wasn't. So when you go to write about an event like that, you partly have the real world, but you partly have this surreal feeling of, did this really happen? Is it real? And then 50 years go by, and all that time, was I really in a war? I remember my dad's last years, we had, this is again in the book, but we'd come to a kind of peace between us. I wasn't sure he liked me, much less loved me. I wasn't sure of that, but and still am not totally, but we had a kind of peace. And when he was old, in his 90s, and we were having a cigarette out on a patio in his retirement home where my mom and he were living. And I asked him, what had happened to your medals from World War II? They used to be in your desk, in your sock drawer. We kept his socks. And he said, what medals? And I said, the medals from World War II. And he said, was I in a war? And I said, yeah, you were at Iwo Jima and Okinawa, and you were in a war. And maybe 5 minutes, we changed topics and went somewhere else. But after 5 minutes, he wasn't in senile dementia entirely, but he was going that way, kind of in and out. But after 5 minutes, he said, oh, yeah. Yeah, those goddamn kamikazes. You sail off to war, the youngest man in the world, and you come home the oldest man in the world. And that makes me tear up because it's a beautiful sentence. It's not just the sentiment. It's you go to war young and you come home old and changed forever. And so he did have that recollection of change. So those memories are not about war. It's about humanity and the selectivity of our own memories and what we cherish and value.
You mentioned your father with regard to some of the Hemingway analyses in the book.
Yes.
And they're some of my favorite pieces.
Thank you.
The Timmy, Tad, and Papa and I sections. Can you talk about why it was so important for you to assign Hemingway stories to the boys and what you hope they'd learn and how the stories affected you?
Well, I'm not a Hemingway aficionado. I love some stories. They're just beautiful. They're flawless. Other stories I quarrel with. I wanted my dad one when I was young, maybe 8 or 9, came into my bedroom one Saturday afternoon in July or August. It was a hot afternoon, and he was carrying this big fat book of Hemingway stories. And I think he had decided to be a father because he said, I want you to pick 5 of these stories. I want you to read them, and I want you to talk to me about them. And then he left. And I'm 8 years old, or 9, and I'm sick of school. It's the summer. And I looked through the book, and I found the shortest stories I could find in the book. One of them was 1 page long, a very short story, one of his great stories. I read Cat in the Rain, which I thought, the story has no story. I had no idea why a writer would write such a terrible story. It just baffled. Now it's among my dearest and most cherished of all his stories, but back then I was just totally baffled. The story is of a woman looking out a window and seeing a cat in the rain. And there's a little tension going on between her husband and the woman. She goes out, looks at the cat, it's not there. She comes back up, and then a maid brings a cat in. Maybe it's the same cat, a different cat, end of story. That's it. On the surface, there's a whole bunch going on underneath that story. But I didn't see it as a kid anyway. What I recalled 50 years later when I began writing this book of my own was I remember waiting for my dad to come home. So fearful. What could I possibly say to him? I had nothing to say about a clean, well-lighted place except, how come that guy at the end couldn't remember the words to the Lord's Prayer? That begins with, you know, my father out and not and out of you, about, you know. I didn't get that it was a riff on nothingness. All I got was, well, how come the guy couldn't remember the words? Even I, at 8 years old, can remember. Nothing to say. My dad didn't ever mention that book to me ever again. He went off drinking, came home late at night, drunk. I think he thought that he forgot that he decided to be a father. But the memory of my fear lasts. So I duplicated some of what my dad tried with my kids on a more modest scale. I didn't give them a whole book, but singly I would ask them to read a story or two. I gave them a very short story. It's 1 page long by Hemingway. It's the story of a romance during World War I that fails. A guy comes home and at the end catches gonorrhea in the back of a taxi cab. So I gave it to Timmy, and he came in and so I said, what did you think? And he said, well, I was embarrassed. And I said, what was so embarrassing? He said, it's embarrassing when your dad gives you a book to read or a story to read about sex diseases. And it's the same phenomenon happened in several other of the stories where it was taken, The Killers was a story about, I'm sure almost all of you have read it, I know Andy has, but almost all of you are literary people, but it's very briefly, it's a story of a boxer who has either failed to take a fall in a fight or has taken, has fallen. He wasn't supposed to. Somebody's, a gambler has paid him. And his name is Ole, and he's on the run, and he ends up in a small Illinois town. Nick Adams shows up, and two killers come in to kill this boxer. And the boxer, Nick goes to warn him, and the boxer says, I'm tired of running. I'm not going to run. I'm going to lie here and take it. I'm paraphrasing, but he says, I'm tired of running. So I asked Timmy after he read it, what did you think of when Ole said, I'm tired of running, I'm going to let people kill me? And Timmy said, I wasn't thinking of that. And I said, what are you thinking of? And he said, well, don't boxers get hit in the face? And I said, yeah. And he said, don't they hit other people in the face? And I said, yeah. And he said, I was thinking, why would anybody ever want to be a boxer? That would make, it makes me laugh. And also, it's, I thought, what a, I got, this is a brilliant literary thing to, that, Hemingway didn't intend, but you, different people are going to draw different things out of stories based on their backgrounds and values, temperaments. And an author is only partly in control, and maybe not even half in control, of what is going to happen inside a reader's heart and head as a story is read. And it, God knows, happened to me a lot of times. I'm totally shocked by responses to things I've written.
Well, speaking of being shocked and writer's intent, and can you talk about how that sometimes goes awry? And I'm thinking in particular about the story, The Man I Killed.
Right.
If you could talk to the audience about that.
I was giving a reading in Chicago. I don't ordinarily give readings. I think books are meant to be read privately. I don't like audio tapes, for example, and things like that. I like to stop and pause, whereas an audio tape just keeps coming at you. You can't. And I gave a reading and started, I choked up over it. It's a story called The Man I Killed, and it's a story that's based on, not, it's made up, but it's comes out of all these corpses around me in Vietnam. I didn't know, still don't know, if I killed anyone. Because you can't see bullets hit things. And because it's so chaotic, and because sometimes your eyes are closed, you're just spraying the whole green living world, mostly out of terror, making this equivalent of saying, go, go away, leave, don't try to kill me. And the result were all these dead people. Some friends of mine, but a lot of Vietnamese. And that story was a way of trying to take responsibility, though I'll never know if a bullet from my weapon killed anyone. I was there. I was a soldier. I pulled the trigger. I hated the war. I was opposed to it. I went anyway. I shouldn't have done that. But I was too young. I couldn't say no to my own country and to my mom and dad and my hometown. I would have felt humiliated, and that people would be talking about me in this small town I grew up in. So I didn't have the courage to do it. So that's what was making me cry up on the stage. I wasn't bawling. It was like the chest chokes. I'd sort of start to, and then I got it under control. And afterward, a young man of 21, 22, somewhere in there, came up to me and said, I want to thank you for being so honest up there. And for showing your heart. He gave me a big hug. And he turned and started to walk away, and he stopped and turned around again and said, by the way, I want to tell you, I've been thinking about joining the Marine Corps, and now I know I'm going to. So I go back to my hotel room, as you do after these events. People around you here, and then you go back, you're all by yourself, and you look in the mirror, and you feel like this failure, like this dumb yo-yo, where you're trying to display something so nasty that's lived inside me for all these years, and it's taken in a completely different way. And I think that's more common than it's uncommon. I think that books and readers brush up against each other, but they don't always go like that. Like strangers having a short conversation and off. And it's another example of control. You can, as a writer, can only do so much, which is to tell a story and then hope that the story will, don't explain it and don't, just let it be. And whatever it does to a human being's heart and head, you have to trust the story. Sometimes it fails. And sometimes it succeeds in ways you don't expect. And sometimes it fails in ways you don't expect. It's the hardest thing for me to have learned over all these years about writing is that I have to trust the story to do its own work without trying to explain anything about it.
Just getting out of its way.
Getting out of the story's way, yeah.
Have you made peace with the idea that you are primarily considered a Vietnam writer? Do you consider yourself a Vietnam writer?
In one way, yes, but mostly no. That when I write about the war in Vietnam or any other war, I'm not writing about bullets and bombs and military maneuvers and saluting and flanking tactics and how you, the mechanics of it all. Not in that sense. I feel that I'm writing, really, I'm a peace writer, what I think. I'm trying to display the horrors of it all. Not just the physical horrors, mostly the internal ones that you carry with you after the peace treaties are signed and the war has been over for 50 years and you're sitting at the dinner table with your children and you go silent and you just can't speak because there's something's intruding, a memory, something has sparked a picture in your head. And I felt for my whole career that I was the opposite of a war writer. I thought I was a peace writer. So when I hear those words, it's a way of I don't know, compressing and pigeonholing and summarizing. You don't call Shakespeare a king writer, for Christ's sake. And Joseph Conrad is an ocean writer. Like he writes about porpoises. It's ridiculous. And Toni Morrison is a black writer. Philip Roth, a Jew writer. It's ridiculous. We're all writers. We have our topics and the things that we bring to our stuff. Vietnam brought something to me, which was moral issues. What should we be killing people? And when do we stop? And when will it stop? And things like that. And is it the right thing to do or the wrong thing to do? How do you say no to something that you don't, that you're told to do that you think you shouldn't do? Things like that matter to me, but not war itself. So it troubles me. I don't know, this is a public library. There's a dirty word in this little anecdote that I've got to say. Do you mind?
Say it.
All right.
We're a First Amendment shop.
I've got to apologize to Timmy and Tad. They're not going to like this.
They're going to love it.
We were in the Bahamas, and I was on this little tiny balcony writing about 3 in the morning. And Tad woke up and came out and said, "What are you writing about?" And you know this story, Andy. I said, "Well, I'm writing about being called, how I hate being called a war writer, which I write about in the book." And he said, "Well, what don't you like?" And I said kind of what I said to you, you know, Shakespeare, king writer, blah, blah, blah. He didn't find it funny. He said, "Well, at least they call you something." And nice. There was a dirty word. I don't have to say the word. Started with an F. That I was getting angry at a guy named Norman Mailer who had called me. He said to me, "Are you that Vietnam writer?" And I instantly hated the guy. I mean, just instantly. Even though he was totally cordial, he wasn't. I think he meant it in a benign sense, you know. But it still was a little pinch. I was like, "Are you that wife-beating writer?" But I didn't do that. I wish I had now. So there's this F word in there that I'm talking to Mailer that was going on in my head, and Tad said, "You can't put that." F word in a book. If somebody reads it, you're going to be in big trouble. And I said, I've got bigger troubles than that. I'm trying to write us about this war writing, pigeonholing thing. And he said, well, yeah. He went back into the room. It was like a sliding glass door. And then he stuck his head out. And he said, well, why don't you just tell them to go F themselves? And that's kind of when he said, well, your question began with how you feel, have I come to terms with it? I did it through Tad, kind of. Just when he says that, that's kind of how I feel. That's like having American cheese written over your face or your Borden's milk. If they want to do it, fuck them.
I knew we'd get there.
I tried to avoid it. But
so in the end, this book, here's my last question before we turn it over to the audience. Do you think the book is more about your fear that Timmy and Tad won't know you, or is it more about you learning how to say goodbye?
What a great question to end on. Wow. I hadn't even considered it, but I think it's at least as much about the latter. How do you say goodbye? There's only one way. You can't speak from the grave. And it's, I think, to leave behind a beauty of shining love of some sort, which I hope this book has in it, that it, amid those pages of the books, I hope some beauty comes out of it, of enduring, lasting love that will live somewhere in their hearts when they're 50 or 73, my age. And it's not just love of them, it's love of kindness and love of human decency and generosity and otherness and love of being a good human being, in addition to my love for the two beautiful boys.
I think all of that shines through. I think you'll see that when you read the book. Tim O'Brien, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
And now I know all of you know how this works. Raise your hand, we'll get you a mic. Who'd like to start us off right here in front?
Thanks very much for coming down.
Thank you.
I hope you wouldn't mind about answering a question about the things they carried.
Not at all.
Some of the perfect stories in the language are in that book.
And thank you.
One of them is the Sweetheart of Song Tra Bong. Mm-hmm. I've read it many times, and I've always wanted to ask you, where does that come from? Is there something real underneath it, or is that
right.
Just...
The story, Sweetheart of the Song Tra Bong, was born in the real world. I heard when I first arrived in Vietnam, before I'd even gone out into the field, I'd just come to my company, just been in Vietnam a day. And there was a guy who was filling a sandbag. He wasn't a combat guy, he was just filling a sandbag. And he said, there was a girl here, and she was up in the mountains, and I didn't believe him. And I heard it a couple more times. I came home, and I remember in Seattle, there was a guy who came through a book signing line and said, I was in your area. Did you hear about this girl who was up in the mountains that her boyfriend had sent for her, and she came? And I still didn't believe it. And I heard it several more times. I still don't know if it's true or not. I don't really care whether it is. But I heard it so many times that I started asking myself, why don't I believe it? And it was just gender. That was it. A same age as I was and all my buddies were, and cultural custom back then, we were only men served in combat, but there's nothing to stop anybody from buying a ticket in Cleveland and flying to LA. They're not going to stop you if you're a recent female college graduate or high school graduate, and they won't stop you in LA. And you can fly from L.A. to Bangkok, and Bangkok, you can fly. Nobody's going to stop you. There's nothing logical or nothing logistical that will stop you. You can do it. And once you're a good-looking cheerleader and you end up in Vietnam, you've got 500,000 people, guys, who will take you anywhere you want to go. You can do it. So there was it was the recognition of gender partly. And then, feeding into it, before even beginning the story, there's a real-life woman named Lady Borton. And this library has a copy of, she's written, I think, two books. And she was in my area where the My Lai massacre had happened a year before I got there. That was full of these mines I talked to you about. It was just a deadly zone, probably the deadliest in all of Vietnam. It was just horrible. And she was a Quaker and was living in a place called Quang Nai City, which was just a town. It wasn't a city. And by town, I mean maybe 1,000 people back then, if that. And she was there without a weapon in a place that we were terrified. 100 of us, armed to the teeth, were just scared to death of this place and everything around this place. So the war ends. All us macho guys have been home for 50 years, their pot bellies. And guess what? She's still there. 50 years later. So, it's the story is an homage to a real person with real courage, real stubborn determination to do good in the world. And she's not out marching on Veterans Day and so on. She's still doing her work. I think she's older than I am. She's close to my age for sure. So sometimes a story is born partly out of abstraction, the gender thing, but also there has to be a human thing that I have to, that has to make me passionate enough to write the story. Vietnam veterans almost uniformly, without, I can think of no exceptions, don't like the story because they say, oh, that couldn't happen. That didn't happen. I never saw that. And in a way, that's accurate. I never saw Mary Ann Bell out there. I don't know if there was a real girl or not. But my heart loves the story. And because it's part of who I've become. Thank you.
Have you been back to Vietnam since the war? And if you have, what were your impressions? And if you have not, why not?
I have been back. I went back reluctantly. Not out of psychological reasons. I went back because I hate airplanes. I'm a smoker. And 24 hours without smoking is dangerous for my health. I mean, I'll die. I'll go insane. I'll jump out of the airplane. I really hate it. But I had a girlfriend at the time. She wanted to go back and see why I cussed in the night and woke up, you know, with dreams. So I went, and I loved the... I saw a new Vietnam. What I saw as a soldier was a war. The word Vietnam equaled war and nothing else, really. It's all it was. It was all around me. And it equaled terror, and it equaled moral guilt and things like that. But on that trip, I found, for example, the place where that grenade episode happened I mentioned earlier tonight, the exact spot where I lay, but in a spot where such horror was unfolding, not just that grenade, this rice paddy was just bubbling with machine gun fire, just total horror. Now at peace, and this yellow sunlight striking the rice, and there was a little boy, maybe, I don't know, 100 yards away, kind of waving at me. And the beauty and serenity of that place now occupies at least a portion of my memory. I saw them both. The horror is not going to ever go away. But now alongside it, there's this beautiful thing called peace that's inside my head now, too. So I'm so glad I went. And have new pictures in my head.
Is that in any way a balance, or is it just simple simultaneity? These two things just exist simultaneous, and one doesn't.
Yeah, They coexist. I wouldn't say quite simultaneously, that when bad things come into my head, I'm absorbed by them. The grenade incident and many others I could mention. But the next day, the next hour, a memory of that little boy. I remember an old woman sitting near on a paddy dike, too. I just remembered this. I'd forgotten this now since 1994 when I went there. She had a translator with me, and she was speaking to this old woman sitting on a paddy dike, just staring at us. And the translator came over, and she said, be really careful. And I said, about what? And she said, well, four of her children were killed in an airstrike on her village. So be really careful about it. I said, can I at least talk to her? She said, no, don't talk to her. So that memory is there, too, that by and large, I felt weirdly forgiven for all the horrors. But I think that woman, like this guy, would have a difficult time forgiving if someone had killed Timmy and Tad. I can't imagine the forgiveness. I hope I could be that way, but I don't think I could be. That's a demerit against me, I guess. But I can't lie either and say I wouldn't be full of grief and anger. I think I would be.
What would you advise your sons if they wanted to enlist?
Well, I probably wouldn't. I probably would not. I'd tell a story of some sort. I'd have to think about what the story is going to be, but I'd have time. I'd say, I don't have to answer you right now. Let me think about it. And I'd try to do it through an anecdote or a story, maybe made up, maybe out of the real world. But I'm sure I wouldn't say don't do it or do it. My dad and mom both treated me that way when I got drafted. They knew I was opposed to the war. They knew I was terrified of going. I didn't believe in it. And I didn't want to die. And I didn't want to kill people. But they never said do it or don't do it. They showed their love for me. And more or less, without direction. And I'm not sure that them telling me to do things, I think that would have gotten in the way of making my mind up. It would have been, it would have gone from what's the morally right thing to do, it would have gone to, mom said go and dad said don't. I'd be thinking about that and not about the thing itself that's was plaguing me. So, but I would tell some kind of a story, maybe one you heard tonight. At one point, Timmy asked me, are you a pacifist? And I said, yes. And Timmy said, well, what if somebody really mean and nasty broke into the house and had a gun and was trying to kill me? What would you do? And I said, well, I'd try to talk to him. And Timmy said, yeah, but what if he's super mean and super nasty and is going to kill me? Would you kill him? And I said, yeah, I'd try to. And he said, what kind of pacifist is that? I said, the father kind. And it's that's the thing about my life. That's maybe thing we started with. I don't believe in killing people. I believe we should do everything we can avoid not to do it. It's forever. What if you're wrong? There's this absolutism thing. When you kill people, it's absolute. They're dead. You can't wake them up if you're wrong. If there are no weapons of mass destruction, you can't wake them up and say, sorry. It's forever. But everything that I think I believe about the world is adjusted and modified by a qualification of some sort, in which then Timmy found one, where I had to admit that there's a contradiction in my personality. And to live with that absence of constancy in my value system. It's not absolute. And very little in my life has ever been that way.
They're going to be pointing that stuff out for the rest of your life.
I know.
Mary?
Hemingway has been mentioned. Would you share with us other writers and specific books that you would like your sons to read as they grow into adulthood?
Excellent question. Revolutionary Road by Richard Yates. I'd have my kids read. It's one of the most beautiful books by an American I've ever read. Not maybe, there, it has its equals, but it's really beautiful. It's a story about a marriage that goes sour and dreams not coming true. Man and wife develop a kind of fantasy of we'll get away from the staleness of our lives, and we'll, I think it's go to France. I read it years, I'm pretty sure to Paris. And it never comes true. It's a sad book, but it's such a deeply human and loving book about desperation with which we pursue personal happiness and beauty in our lives. And if you don't have it, you want to try whatever you can do, including escape to somewhere else, to find it. Turgenev's Fathers and Sons, I would recommend anybody who loves the mix of contention and love that happens between fathers and sons. There are two fathers and two sons in this beautiful novel. There's also another novel by Turgenev I'd recommend, which is called First Love. It's about a boy who falls in love with a woman. Yeah, I think the boy is like 17, the woman's like 20-something. And it's his first love, and it turns out that the woman is his father's mistress. And it's heartbreaking. It was decried in Russia when it was written as too light. But I didn't find it light. I found it heartbreaking and a little spooky. Flaubert loved it. He'd written a letter to Turgenev saying how much he loved it. There's a short story by André Debus, the elder, called A Father's Story. That if you read this story and don't feel you've been changed forever, I'd be shocked. It changed me, and everybody I know who's read it has felt as I do. There's never been anybody who said that didn't do anything to me. It's you can find it, I think, online. You don't have to buy a book. You can just read. You should. He's got written many beautiful stories. Or you should check it out at the library for sure. There's one difficulty with answering that question, though, which is memory again. I'm on a stage and you've asked a question, and I'm sure there are Lolita, I mean, I love, for a whole this gifted pervert who almost convinces the reader that what he's doing, which is pedophilia, is good. It's shocking. And we're the sort of this guy's jury, you know, he calls it love and so on, and we call it, you know, child molestation. And he's so nimble of mind and so gifted with language that he's almost convinces you that this is a good thing. But the word almost matters a lot. And so I've left out so many books that I've loved.
We'll come back.
Good, I'd love to. This is what I just love being here. Andy and I have been friends for, I don't know how many years, like 25 or something like
90,
that, or more.
91.
God.
A while.
I'm not.
Since before
you're
I was born.
A lot older than I am.
Yeah. I'm working on it.
I wasn't born until 92.
It's a contest.
Hi, thank you for being here. As I was sitting here waiting for you to come on stage, I just read the first chapter of your book, and it's really beautiful and a wonderful gift to give to your sons.
Thank you.
But what I would like to ask about is in the Lake of the Woods. I'm a college professor, and I taught that novel a lot. And my students loved it. Of course, I recognized the magic tricks that you were talking about.
Right.
And my students really loved it, but they were kind of frustrated that they didn't know what happened to Kathy. And I'm not going to ask you what happened to her, but I'm just...
That's a good question.
But I just wonder if, while you were writing it, you knew what happened to her.
Well, I'm the author, and I don't know what happened. And that's why I wrote that book. I wanted to write a book where I don't know what this goes back to this explaining thing I was talking about like a half hour ago. I wanted to be mystified by my own characters. A woman vanishes, and a bunch of hypotheses are offered of what happened to her. And I don't know what, as an author, I don't want to know. I'm beguiled and tantalized by the unknown and even by the unknowable. What happens when we die? Is there a heaven or a hell? And is St. Peter really going to be there in person? Or is it symbolic? I don't know, and none of us are going to know. And maybe there's nothing to know. Who knows? I'm tantalized by Amelia Earhart. Every other week on the Discovery Channel, there's a new, you know, her shoe found the shores of Borneo or something. And I'm tantalized by Lizzie Borden. Did she take an axe and do that? She was found innocent. And she never confessed. On the other hand, she was the only person in the house with these two dead people. And there was a maid who was outside washing windows, but would periodically come into the house, who took, you know, but Lizzie was tried, found innocent. She never confessed. I don't know. O.J. Simpson, I have my opinions about what happened, but there were no eyewitnesses. And anyway, I'm tantalized on the plot sense by things I don't know, but I'm mostly tempted and tantalized by what I don't know about myself, why I'm sitting up here now. I could give you rational things. My preference would be to be right now with Timmy and Tad watching myself on YouTube. From, you know, 2 months from now. It's not that I dislike being here. I love it. I love this book. That's part of why I'm here, I guess. That this beauty thing, something shining for the boys. But In Lake of the Woods was written as a book where what began as a mystery is going to remain one. I warn the reader on page 15, if you're looking for a solution, buy another book. They're not going to get it, so I played fair. But solved mysteries aren't mysteries. They're solved. They're unmysteries. So in this library, you ought to go to the mystery section, and they ought to just change the title, Unmysteries. Every book, all of them are solved. They're unmysteries. And I wanted to write one that was mystery even to me. And I know it sounds facetious, but I earnestly mean what I'm saying, that I am fascinated by what is unknown. What were Custer's last thoughts at the Little Bighorn? What were they? Well, we can't know it. Was he aware that he was about to receive exactly what he had come prepared to deliver? Death of, in this case, you know, Native American Indians. That's what he came and he was getting it. And did you see the irony? And I doubt it from what I've read of Custer, but maybe, who knows? Mystery in life it's kind of what I live for. I don't want, if I know something, I want to unknow it so I can be full of wonder and awe at this world we live in.
Well, we're full of wonder and awe. Ladies and gentlemen, Tim O'Brien.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.